Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sports, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Keith Rathbone, and I usually say I'm coming to you live from Macquarie University, but today I'm coming to you live from my house in Sydney. And so you might hear some noise in the background from my four-year-old daughter or my six-month-old son, and for that I apologize ahead of time. And I especially apologize to the person I'm speaking to today. Matt Taylor is a professor of history at De Montfort University, and he is the author of just, I was joking with him before the recording, the book I wish I had read most before I wrote my own book. His book is called Sport and the Home Front, Wartime Britain at Play, 1939-1945. It's out with Routledge with their Studies in Modern British History in 2020. Thank you so much for joining me, Matt, finally. And sorry, I have to apologize to him again because I've canceled on Matt, I think, twice now. So thank you for finally getting on the phone with me after I've been so rude.
Nah, not at all. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be able to speak to you finally, Kay.
Yeah, I have to say, like I was saying to you before, I love this book. And there was so much I drew from it personally, and I wanted to know how you developed this project. Where did it come from? How did you conceive of it? Is it something you've been working on for a long time, or was its generation really rapid?
The former. this, like quite a lot of books, I suppose, had quite a long gestation period. In actual fact, it's linked back to the first piece of academic work I ever did, which is while I was doing my PhD, which was on the kind of social history of football in England. And in the context of that, myself and my supervisor at the time, Pierre Lanfranchi, were invited to contribute a chapter to a book that colleagues at De Montfort were putting together on the kind of cultural and social history of the Second World War. And they wanted something on football. And so that's when I first it wasn't the same period as my PhD, slightly afterwards. So I did a little bit of work on that with Pierre. And I thought, I think there's a little bit more to find out here. And in the meantime, did another couple of book projects, and I came back to it around about, so that was initially in the 1990s. I came back around about 2010, I think it was. What's my next book project going to be after finishing quite a big book on the history of football in Britain called The Association Game? I was thinking, well, what do I do next? And I thought, well, hang on, there may be something here. There may be a couple of articles. Did the articles, did a bit of research. And I think the process in a way was all the time thinking, well, might this be enough for a book? Might this be enough for a book? And if I'm being honest, that continued to be the question I asked myself up to the end of, the completion of the book and possibly post-publication as well. I was still thinking, is there enough? And I think I've just about proved there is enough. But it was a project that I was interested in from my first research work, I became very interested in the kind of broader historiography, not on sport, but on the kind of the home front and the social history, social and cultural history of the home front. And I was increasingly thinking to myself, well, great books here, but there's a gap. They say very little about leisure and they say very little about sport specifically. And I think sport does add significantly to what we know about them, what we can know about how people behaved in the home front, but what they thought and how it connected to notions of social citizenship, the nation, and various broader, I think, research questions. So that's how it came about, really, Keith.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, my own interest lies very much in the same area. And I do wonder, like, I have my own thoughts, but I wonder what you're thinking. Why, in this story of the Second World War, why has sport been so neglected? I was shocked when I found out how many people were playing sports in France. And I was equally shocked in reading your book and finding out just how vibrant sport was in Britain, because I was under the impression that it, even now, you know, until reading it, that it was not as prevalent. So why has sport been so neglected as part of these stories?
Yeah, well, I think I address this to a degree in the kind of introduction to the book and in various other places. I think it partly comes from, I suppose, both the kind of historiography on sport and and those who have written, you know, more broadly on the kind of social and cultural history of the war. In terms of sport, I just think that there seems to be this notion, certainly in terms of work on Britain, that you know, there's not much to say about the Second World War. Yeah, I mean, people played a little bit. You know, the government tended to be, you know, generally recognise it as being of some use to the war effort. But, you know, there wasn't a great deal of debate. There wasn't a great deal going on. I think that's the other view. And I think kind of that fits in many ways to the fact that, you know, that in terms of the key sports, you know, none of the international matches or key matches that took place are recognised as genuine caps for players or genuine, you know, they're the wartime competitions, the wartime finals, you know, and they don't go into the record books. They're not statistically recognised. So the idea that this is a kind of an interruption, I think, comes from those, in inverted commas, sports historians working on the area. And I think for those more generally, I think there is an element of a continuation of this idea that, you know, well, how important can something which really was relatively trivial compared with the other important aspects of people's life, how important can that be? But then if we think about, you know, how, you know, the huge amount of work that's been done on film and cinema and things like this, you know, which recognized almost from the beginning as being extremely important, not just in terms of propaganda, but in how people engaged with the war and how, you know, how they dealt with it in terms of their free time and how they took time away. And so it is, you know, it's an odd thing that sport, you know, has been, maybe there's a sense that enough has been covered in terms of, you know, looking at other forms of entertainment, you know, which has been, you know, certainly cinema has been covered very well. But I would suggest that, you know, alongside sport, other forms of kind of entertainment and leisure also, you know, still have their histories to be written.
I want to really, we're on New Books in Sports. I think I'm preaching to the choir a little bit, I'm sure, when I say this, but I want to stress, Matt, your book is not just, it's not a kind of, although it is quite comprehensive in many ways, and I mean that as a compliment, it's not a compendium of sporting events. It's deeply argumentative about what sport means for this notion of the people's war and how sport helps to shape or to pull apart the ties of unity that people assume were generated by the wartime in Britain. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what were your broader, like, theoretical aims, like what was it that you were trying to show us through sport? I know that it's not just that it happened, but I guess I'm asking you, give people the big thrust.
Yeah, no, I suppose it was to it came from this inkling, I think, that I had when I first started kind of, you know, uncovering the what happened element of it. And actually, you know, you're absolutely correct. The what happened is just a starting point. You know, it's a starting point for them realizing, okay, there was some sport going on. And even when there wasn't, you know, people debated, you know, if there were restrictions, you know, why, and et cetera, et cetera. And I think for me, I became really interested in these, obviously the idea of the People's War, which has been much debated, you know, I suppose in many ways, kind of its reality as against the way in which, you know, in the post-war period, you know, the idea has really been developed and has become an important part of people's memories and popular memory of the Second World War. But I was interested in connecting it to some of the ideas around, I think, citizenship and national identity. And as you say, the kind of the notions of unity, but also the fractures that existed in kind of the notion of the nation, what the nation means at a time of war. And I was really interested to give an idea of kind of the books that influenced. I mean, I was really particularly kind of influenced by Sonia Rose's work, Which People's War, her book, Which People's War, which was really very much about that issue, about, you know, the tensions between calls to unity in terms of the notion of you know, we're involved in a people's war, but within that also the obvious and clear tensions between, you know, a range of things in relation to gender. She talks about gender. She talks about the split between city and countryside, the split between regions, issues of race, which do feature a little bit in my book as well. And so I think it was one of the big ideas that I wanted to explore in relation to sport, because it seemed to me very clear that in the rhetoric of what sport meant for those who both at various times who kind of supported but also challenged it, it was connected very closely to these broader debates about the People's War, these broader debates about, you know, what are we contributing to the war effort, and how are we being, in inverted commas, good citizens? And actually, you know, keeping your sports club going, you know, some people interpreted as very closely linked to good citizenship. But at other times of the war, you know, playing to you know, going to bet, for instance, on the dogs, or spending your afternoon at the dog track, could be considered quite the opposite. That was someone who wasn't contributing to the war in any way. And so it shifted at different times, but it's clear that's because sport meant things to lots of people, and even for those for whom it didn't mean a lot, they recognised it was important to those who were significant to the war effort, kind of war workers, servicemen and women. You know, it was absolutely clear that it fed into these broader debates. And I suppose, yeah, it's not, I'm not answering in terms of a big theoretical approach, but I was very interested in kind of testing those sorts of ideas, which have really come to the fore in some of the best writing on the kind of social and cultural history of wartime Britain, and really testing to what extent sport both fitted challenge, but kind of added to those debates and to what we know in terms of those things.
Yeah, I mean, I think you were extremely successful, and the book itself, for people who haven't read it or who would like to know more about it, it's actually structured really thematically. And so when I first looked at the organization, I was like, I wasn't anticipating it when I first picked it up. But I thought it really worked well. And so the first chapter in some ways deals with, this is the chapter, Sport, the Government and Civilian Morale, deals with that big question. I mean, why play sport during a war at all, right? And so I guess, you know, I'd start us out with that question. You know, how strong was the movement to kind of ban sport during the war? What was the, you know, kind of initial impetus for banning it or keeping it?
Yeah. So, I mean, and that in a sense was the first chapter that I worked on as well. When I was talking about kind of the articles that I initially started on, I kind of began there, because in one sense that was the broader frame, I suppose, for understanding lots of the other issues. And in terms of kind of, you know, archival material as well, it allowed me to go and, you know, look at, you know, fairly substantial number of files in the National Archives, which were linked to Home Office and Ministry of Home Security files on the three really significant sports that they were concerned about, which was soccer, horse racing and greyhound racing. In terms of the how it fits in with, you know, these debates, you know, should we play and the movement kind of for and against, I suppose the general sense, which I think is correct, if we compare it in Britain to the attitudes in the Second World War compared to the First World War, is that generally there was support for the notion that there is some value in playing sport. And partly that linked to the notion, the chapter is based around this idea of civilian morale, which doesn't come from a retrospective imposition of this notion. This was very much discussed by the government, by social research organisations which worked for the government, such as Mass Observation, which features quite a lot in the book, and other research agencies. And it was really important because it was linked to this concern about what was going to happen when the war started, the fear that there would be the immediate threat of air attack and bombing. And so issues of safety became really important in that sense. And so plans had been made to make sure, certainly in the early weeks of war, that all entertainments and places of entertainment and sporting events and things like this would cease in the first few weeks. There's a sense in some of the writing on that was kind of worked out, you know, amongst the authorities, you know, in the first few days. Not really. It had already been decided kind of a year before that's what would happen on the outbreak of war. And so there wasn't a huge amount of challenge, to the fact that initially sports places and places of entertainment were closed down. But there was a recognition that would soon be eased. And so what then happens, I think, is that there are particular groups that are campaigning for more sport. The sports authorities are engaged with the government at national level, and then, you know, later kind of at local level with different authorities. And it very much depends, you know, attitudes centrally amongst politicians and more broadly, I suppose, amongst those who were pushing for more sport to take place. It very much depended on different periods of the war. And so there was a shift. It was a forever shifting story, really, in terms of, you know, how government policy, for instance, developed. It's not enough to say, you know, the government generally, you know, the government recognised that sport was a good thing, so let's give as much opportunity as possible to do that. That was their kind of default position, but that varied at significant times in the war. So, you know, at the beginning of the war, there were restrictions, then there were eased generally, and then a number of those restrictions came back in the summer of 1940 with the fall of France and kind of significant concerns about an imminent invasion. And they were eased at various times, and then they came back the restrictions came back very strongly at the beginning of 1942 with the reverses in the war, fall of Singapore, and particularly a lot of concerns about the seriousness of the war effort on the home front, and that certain groups and certain people weren't giving as much as they could to the war effort. And actually, you know, certain sports became the focus of attention at that time, particularly kind of boxing that was taking place at the Albert Hall in you know, afternoons when war workers, you know, should have been at work. And so there was another kind of push to restrict at that point in 1942. So it was a shifting story, which makes it very interesting, I think, because the arguments aren't consistent and they change at various times. And the emphasis, you know, placed on certain parts of the argument, you know, are more prominent at certain points than they are elsewhere. So I think it very much varies, and it also varies on the basis of sport. You know, the first chapter really kind of leads the reader through the fact that, you know, there were different attitudes within government, you know, in relation to sports like soccer, which was very much, you know, recognised as being key to the morale of the imagined male, and it was generally imagined as the male war worker initially, and the serviceman, horse racing, which had a lot of governmental support anyway, but it was realised its links with gambling and things like that, they needed to be more careful with it, and greyhound racing, which had very little support within the government. And so that kind of was hardest hit. So yeah, it kind of varies. I think the variety and the shift, as I say, the shifting story that I tell is really, you know, how you understand, you know, the how attitudes varied at different times.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that comes out throughout the book, especially in this first chapter, you're kind of setting the stage for it, is just how much, you know, within the context of this idea of the People's War, how much actual kind of layering and nuance there is. You're talking about social class, you're talking about region, you're talking about gendered notions of sport, always a lot of commentary on women in sport in the book, and also the timeline, the sport, different kinds of sport. And one thing that really surprised me in reading it, coming from the French perspective, where I had to kind of needle out some of this, but just the diversity of different government agencies that had a kind of finger in the pie of sport. I was honestly flipping back and forth to keep some of the acronyms in my head, because there were so many different groups that were
that's certainly something that I didn't anticipate, and certainly the book, just I mean, to give an idea about, you know, for those who haven't, you know, like in terms of source, I mean it is that, you know, I do use kind of official government sources, you know, various points throughout the book, but they're kind of that I intersperse that with kind of, you know, personal sources and things like that, which I'm kind of really interested in. But very much this chapter very much is based on certainly a part of it is kind of tracing the way in which the government policy developed. And what I was very surprised about, you know, as you say you were, I was, when I was doing the research, was how many different government departments were involved in the decisions that were made, and the fact that they were competing effectively at various times. So, you know, it was well known that certain departments, such as the Ministry of Labour, and the Ministry of Health, but particularly the Ministry of Labour, were very pro sport in any context, you know, and maintained that position almost from the beginning, whereas other bodies, the service departments, so the Army, Navy and Air Force, were involved in these decisions as well. Obviously they were much more circumspect about it, but the most kind of powerful, certainly as the war developed by 1943, 1944, the most powerful of the government departments, which kind of opposed sport going ahead as much as possible, and kind of were very much in favour of restrictions, was the Ministry of War Transport. The Ministry of War Transport became very, very powerful in 43 and 44. And one of the interesting things, that was one of the key figures there, was a chap called Philip Noel Baker, who was a former Olympic athlete and later became very significant in kind of post-war sports policy. But he was the key kind of opponent of increasing the amount of sport taking place because of, you know, transport reasons. So yeah, the range of agencies just within the government is really an interesting factor, of understanding the kind of complexity of, you know, how policy was developed.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
One of the things that comes out in your book too, and I think I was just, you talking about this is making me kind of flip back in my head and laugh at the number of times in which people were getting in trouble for driving too far in their cars, the civil defense driving too far to go to matches.
Yeah.
But the story that you're telling is not, of course, just one of top down kind of imposition of sports, but also the kind of dramatic interest in sports despite the war from ordinary people. And so your second chapter, which I really liked, is about sporting clubs and you call it carrying on. So I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit about, you know, what were the challenges that sporting clubs faced, both material challenges, challenges that the state was putting forward, things like that, and how that they tried to overcome those, and if they were able or unable to do that.
Yeah, no, I kind of, that was one of the chapters, I think, where I was saying earlier on that, you know, I was trying to work out, you know, what is there to find out here? I really wanted it to not be a book which was top down, and that it really was, you know, about people's individual experiences, and in terms of sport, that it very much looked at the grassroots. That's sometimes difficult in terms of, you know, finding archival sources, but I think actually there's quite a lot to help by looking at the material that's available in the Second World War in terms of not just kind of club archives and how the press dealt with it, but the fact that we've got some kind of useful materials from National Playing Fields Association records and mass observation and various things like that, which were interested in sport. So, yeah, I mean, I think the first issue that kind of grassroots clubs had was simply the decision itself. Do we carry on or don't we carry on? And generally, they got the thumbs up from the government. I say it varied at different times, and they got the thumbs up generally from national bodies. But even so, clubs often made decisions based on what I was really interested in was how significant, you know, what happened in the First World War was on kind of both helping kind of club committees make their decisions about what they would do in the Second World War, but also in providing, you know, the language, the same language that was used. So quite often in making their kind of statements to the press or to ordinary members, committees would kind of repeat, you know, the approach that they'd taken last time, or kind of slightly modify it, but refer to their previous approach. So certain clubs decided not to continue playing because they'd done the same in 1914-18. Others kind of adopted, you know, we will continue. We did this in earlier, you know, and would kind of develop a similar sort of language. So although the situation, the context was different, the First World War was important as a kind of precedent. So that was the first thing. But then I guess there were a number of kind of justifications for clubs carrying on. And a lot of them did mirror, I suppose, what government departments said and other advocates said at central level. It was linked to improving physical fitness. It was linked to providing those in important war jobs and services with a break from their war duties. That was a kind of first significant justification. But really interesting was the other two, in a sense, that there was a real focus on, you know, we need to keep clubs alive. And the reason we need to keep clubs alive is precisely for those who can't attend at the moment, precisely for those overseas in the forces. You know, we're doing it for the boys. And that was a really powerful and frequent argument. And then that was also linked to the fact that these clubs also needed to be kept alive for younger generations. So there was a lot of there's a lot of emphasis on youth and the importance of those coming through. And, you know, we have to keep these clubs alive to allow, you know, to, not just for the future of sport in this country, but kind of the future of, manhood, British manhood and womanhood, in the sense. In terms of the restrictions, I mean, there were financial restrictions, which were really important, kind of membership problems. One of the key aspects, I suppose, about the kind of geography of the population in Second World War Britain. Obviously, lots of people in the forces were away from home at various times, but many even in the forces would spend a lot of the war at home on the home front. But a really significant aspect of people's experience was mobility. People were moving. If they were in the forces, they were moving for work. Often, you know, workplaces would move, you know, from areas which were less safe to areas which were safer. So the mobility of people obviously made made it very difficult for lots of clubs to exist in terms of simply having enough people to play and having the finances. Obviously, if people moved to certain places, then there would be new members potentially. So finances were often a problem, and clubs used a variety of kind of ways of kind of dealing with that. Getting people who were non-playing members to contribute, often reducing the amount of subscriptions so that, you know, people who were struggling could still be play a part. And so there were the membership problems. There was also the significance of the entertainment tax, which had been a factor in relation to kind of British entertainment and British sport since 1916, since the First World War. And so there were campaigns to reduce the size of the contribution that clubs needed to make to the entertainment tax. And then there were the very practical things about rationing of food, you know, food that was put on for visiting teams, and clothing and equipment. You know, that had a significant effect on sports clubs, you know, from the very top. I mean, famously, kind of Manchester United, when the Old Trafford was bombed, lost 13 sets of jerseys and kit, and so had to borrow kit from other clubs. And then when rationing on clothing really took hold, clubs basically asked for their kits back. So a lot of these teams, even at the higher levels, were kind of short of kit. And this was even more significant at lower levels. So there was a lot of the campaigning that governing bodies at sport were doing was really with the Board of Trade to actually manage to acquire a few more clothing coupons. And clubs would even, you know, ask their supporters to pass on any spare clothing coupons they had. But that in itself became sometimes quite controversial, you know, in the sense that there would be complaints and letters to the press that, you know, why are sports clubs being prioritised when our ordinary workers, our ordinary coal miners and people in important professions are having to go to work in rags. And so at the heart of all these debates was this notion, I think, which fed through, you know, all aspects of domestic life in Britain, was the notion of equality and the idea that, you know, we need to ensure that there's fairness and equality amongst different groups, which often wasn't achieved, but was really at the heart of lots of these debates. So clubs have really significant problems. Many clubs, you know, cease to exist. But I think one of the interesting things was how many clubs managed to keep functioning and keep going under these incredibly trying circumstances.
Yeah, the one that comes through, I think, pretty strongly throughout your book, which is that in difficult circumstances, oftentimes club leaders, individual athletes, sporting officials, they often work together or work, if not together, then they work creatively to try to keep things alive. I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but one of the kind of fights that I think you can see this kind of contestation, but also creativity, and also kind of debates about equality is the fight over Sunday sport, which was really, it's not in this chapter, but it's kind of a similar kind of set of issues. Can we play sports on Sunday? Who can play sports on Sunday? What sports can be played on Sunday? And what regions? So you get that kind of contestation, but also cleverness in some of the circumstances to keep sport alive, because for a lot of people it was a very important part of their wartime experience that came really strongly.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because I suppose many kind of episodes in the book are about contestation over resources, contestation over space, and over kind of traditions, which I suppose in the sense of kind of what we do with Sunday sport, can we, given the fact that most clubs and governing bodies and councils initially were very reticent to open facilities on Sundays, but it led to a broader kind of opening up of what do we stand for, what do we represent both as a nation, and more significantly kind of at local level as a kind of council and things like that. How do we balance the importance to our nation of keeping people fit and happy and being good and focused war workers, as against the impact that people playing on a Sunday might have on those who are very religious and kind of regard it as a significant problem in terms of the way they see the nation and the way they see the way in which even a nation at war should maintain traditions. Part of the things we're fighting for are, many people argue, are certain traditions, and we can't let those go, even in the most trying of circumstances. So these challenges which took place they do take place on a national stage, but the very interesting thing, is the fact that quite often these decisions are being made at kind of regional and local levels, with slightly different outcomes, in each place. So, Sunday sport might be allowed at certain times in one city, 20 miles down the road, there might be a different viewpoint.
I love like the one guy in Birmingham just blocking all of Sunday sport or whatever. He's in charge and he doesn't like that. So no one in Birmingham.
So some of the amateur associations just said, this is our tradition, so we will not. And then there were connections made to we represent the nation then more fully than down in London where they're allowing it to go ahead. And so there were kind of these anti-metropolitan undertones to a lot of the arguments quite often. So and those things, are part of the debates as well.
I almost felt like that could have been. In your subtitle, even is how rich the kind of local versus metropolitan contest can be. And it's not just, obviously you point out the tensions in Scotland or in Wales, which have, as you point out in several different chapters, different notions of what the nation or the people might be in the first place. But also just within England itself and how the kind of home counties become a symbol in many ways, but also a symbol that a lot of people reject. I thought that was really well done throughout the work.
Yeah, and it partly relates to, I suppose, to, again, different experiences. Certain parts of the country, suffered bombing, in a way that others didn't. And that wasn't, of course, just regionalized. Kind of urban areas were very significantly impacted, obviously kind of Coventry, Birmingham, Belfast, Liverpool, you know, so these cities, you know, very much were affected by bombing, as well, of course, as London was. However, in certain other parts of the North and Midlands of England, for instance, there was, where there wasn't much impact in terms of, you know, and on a day-to-day concern, there was this sense that, you know, okay, you know, there's some, you know, there is this kind of residual tension that somehow there's more focus on, you know, the problems in London. However, you know, there's an element of guilt. You know, we're not really experiencing it in the same way. And we recognise, you know, that the impact on us isn't quite the same. So yeah, the fact that people, that there were different, you know, experiences in different contexts, which also kind of cross cuts, you know, I suppose the more straightforward kind of regional tensions, which are in wartime are building on, yeah, they're building on the peacetime tensions as well.
Your book finishes with like four extremely, I think, really well argued chapters, and your work. I'm conscious of the time that we probably can't talk about all of them, but there's a chapter, work, fitness, and play, on the kind of contested notion of what is fitness, how do we achieve military preparedness. There's a chapter on called Sport and Everyday Life in Wartime that looks at what everyday life even means. And this one in particular, I mean, I have Everyday Life in the title of my book, and I was like, I needed to read this book first. I could have used this. A chapter on broadcasting and wartime sport and how sports broadcasting changes, and then the final chapter on sport, war, and the nation, and complicating this idea of the people's war and the nation's war. So, Matt, do you have a preference about which ones we're able to talk about? I think we'd be really rushing and doing injustice if we tried to talk about all of them. But
well, I mean, how about? I mean, I think I've hinted a couple of times at the kind of how important, I suppose, looking at personal narratives was for me, yeah, in the book. And so the chapter you mentioned on kind of sport and everyday life, and, you know, I'm absolutely not, by the way, I'm not at all convinced that I've nailed, you know, the huge amount of, you know, debates around what, you know, how historians deal with notions of everyday life. I barely scratched the surface, and I was aware of that in terms of kind of trying to frame it. But it was clear to me that I had to have something about this, because it was, I think, one of the key parts of my argument was, I think that just as an element of certain people's lives, not everyone's by any mean, but certain number of people's lives, sport became a part of the everyday, and the everyday became incredibly significant in a wartime context. You know, it effectively, the everyday became politicized. You know, people, what people do in every moment of the day kind of almost becomes an element that is important to us. How they spend their time, you know, how to the extent that they're careful with their resources, to the extent to which they are keeping themselves fit, not for themselves or their family only, but for their nation, and, you know, doing their bit. So I think it was really important that I had this chapter which addressed this idea, and that I really kind of made as much use as possible of the kind of personal narratives that I really, you know, was absolutely searching for this. I was helped, I think, I mentioned it a couple of times, but I was helped a bit by the fact that the historians of this period have the Mass Observation Archive.
So yes, for people, I'm extremely jealous of Mass Observation.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great resource. I have done a kind of a course which is on kind of wartime Britain in War and Peace, which kind of basically traces this period of mass observation. So basically, it was a social research organization established in the late 1930s and kind of continued into the 1940s. It actually still exists in a different form, and so it's still operating, and the archive is great because basically they had lots of different forms of generating material, but the two main ones were they would send investigators out to just see what was happening and note down people's experiences, But the one I use a little bit more, I think, is the what we call the directives or the national panel. So what would basically be sent out would be monthly questionnaires, effectively, to about 2,000 people. It varied the numbers during the war at different times, who would respond to issues of the day and, you know, politics. What do you think of Churchill? What do you think of Stafford Cripps? What do you think of various people? You know, how are things going in, you know, in... you know, parts of Western Europe and the East and things like that. So various aspects of the war, but also, you know, they were very interested in just people's ordinary lives. So what do you think about, you know, notions? What do you think about spiritualism? What are your views of religion? And sport was one of the things, not the major thing, but one of the things they were consistently interested in. So I particularly use one questionnaire from 1942, which was one of these times, early 1942, where there were lots of debates about, you know, should sport be more restricted? Should it continue? Which asked people their opinion on that question. So I was able to use that particularly in the first chapter. But the second question was in really useful for me, particularly in this part of the book, which asked people about what were their experiences of war. And what you got often there was kind of potted histories, but reflections as well on what sport has meant to them, or if it didn't mean much to them, you know, what it meant, why it didn't mean much to them, what it meant to other people. And so you can tap into those sorts of things to really get a sense of, you know, how sport had become a part of people's, you know, people's histories and their everyday existence at wartime. So with that alongside, you know, kind of unpublished and published memoirs, which there are kind of more increasingly those that have been found out, some great stuff at the Imperial War Museum. You know, I was able to kind of get a sense of what, in inverted commas, ordinary people, what their experiences of sport in the war were, which I think was really, really valuable and probably, in a sense, my favourite, probably the bit of the book I liked most, that I was kind of, because I thought that was going to be something I was really going to struggle with, and I got a little bit more than I expected.
Yeah, one of the things that tied together, and for me at least, this chapter on everyday life and then the next chapter on broadcasting, was the way in which sport could be used to promote a sense of normalcy within an abnormal situation, you know, with this emphasis on sport and the reminiscences that sporting locations could and sporting events could produce for people, kind of as a way to like generate either on the radio or in you know in person, you know, positive feelings in an otherwise kind of like difficult time. And so those two chapters in particular, and I was reading the part where these children are playing sport during the evacuation, and that's like a way to remain kind of tied in, and they're inviting their parents to come to sports days, and I'm like, how, I'm just thinking to myself how hard that would have been. And then people listening to the radio, listen, you know, them finding the right sports stars to talk about the big events of the 1930s to bring it up so they can kind of reminisce, and how that helped promote morale in this otherwise difficult time. That was really, I think, a great part of the book.
Yeah, no, I mean, it became, because one of the interesting things, in a way, I mean, I know we started by saying, you know, both of us, I think, you know, oh, it's amazing how much sport was going on, which is true. But I think particularly in dealing with the kind of chapter on the BBC and radio and broadcasting wartime sport was the fact that, yeah, there was a lot going on, but there wasn't as much going on as in peacetime. So the kind of key role the BBC played in ensuring that sport, which they recognised very early on, was one of a number of things which were going to be crucial in terms of, you know, in terms of their wartime broadcasting policy. It stood alongside particular types of music and comedy and various other things as a key to what became called the Forces Programme. So the Forces Programme was particularly for that imagined, well, imagined but real service listener who would be listening perhaps at home but abroad as well when they're on service. So the BBC did a lot to facilitate as much sport taking place as possible, which I didn't realize until I kind of looked deep into the kind of the BBC written archives, that they were actively trying to create competitions and create events. But obviously they could only do that to a certain extent. So they came very early on the significance of kind of producing a kind of an approach which focused on reminiscence of sport in you know, big matches, big clubs in the 30s particularly, and, you know, going further back. So, you know, sport becomes something in the imagination. Sport becomes something which is kind of connected to notions of nostalgia and how the listener kind of imagines a pre-war and might look ahead to a post-war. And so I think it has a very significant role in terms of that, which kind of feeds into then kind of how you know, various authorities, but also ordinary clubs, think about what sport may look like in a period after the war, so how it links to Reconstruction. So yeah, this idea of reminiscent sport and the nostalgia associated with it was really something I was surprised about, but really becomes very important. And so these programs which focus on that become the key, at various times, the key sports programs which are broadcast on the BBC.
And that same kind of, you know, imagination of sport continues into your final chapter. And it's funny that you said, oh, you know, I was worried that this wasn't enough for a book, because reading your last chapter, I was like, oh my gosh, there's like four books here. And you even at times you kind of remark, you know, like, oh, you know, more research needs to be done on this, or, you know, there's this interesting thing here. And then, you know, it's like you devote a couple pages to it, but I can see it being a whole book all on its own. Not to scoop any future projects of yours, but you know, anyone who's in British history and is looking for projects, this last chapter is chockers with them. But I think, you know, just to link it with the radio chapter, I mean, the role that cricket plays in people's imagination of what they're fighting for is pretty important. So I wonder if you can talk to us about this last chapter, because I do think it was a big chapter. It's obviously an important chapter where you try to bring back a lot of these threads back to this question of the people's war, and you even kind of try to separate out what the nation is versus what the people are in the people's war. And so I guess I was hoping you could unpack this last chapter for us, because it's really rich, really rich final chapter.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a tricky one, because it was the chapter where which probably explains the fact that there were lots of things which were talked about for a little bit and then might have been developed more, that it was the one where, oh, you know, I found some material here. Now this needs to go in the final chapter. This needs to go in the final, because there was so, in a way, I think what I was trying to do with this chapter is, you know, it can be read on its own, but it really, I think, picks up, you know, as you said, a number of the threads which really are running through the book, you know, the debates throughout the book, which is the extent to which sport becomes, how it becomes seen, and how the narratives around sport are connected to those of the nation, and how far it was argued about in terms of you know, the key debates around the People's War, that this is a war which we're all in together, you know, despite class, you know, despite our class divisions and despite those things, and whatever those divisions, things are unified and we need to kind of connect those together. So for instance, I was particularly interested in things like the way in which, you know, sporting metaphors were used, you know, by the press in various contexts of the war. And there's lots of examples of that. There's these kind of great examples where, you know, BBC journalists and other journalists would kind of, which did happen, would kind of watch air battles taking place during the Battle of Britain, and would commentate on them as if they were, you know, sporting events. And so that was very common, and there was, but it also generated a fair amount of criticism from those who would say, you know, it's this idea is, you know, the kind of George Orwell idea, you know, war by another means. And, you know, so people would argue that that was the case, but would also, you know, undermine it very significantly and say, well, actually, you know, we have to think about this in very different ways. This is not sport. Things are more important in those sense. So you had those sorts of debates. And I think I was also interested in terms of how the war connected with ideas of assumed ideas of fair play and fairness and sportsmanship. These notions of how British projected themselves in relation to sport, but actually which went well beyond sport. I mean, in fact, just recently, a book that I would have really usefully used for this book had it been published at the time. I just reviewed a book which is about forget the name of the author, which is about a kind of history of fair play and the narrative and discourse of fair play. And that comes into this book as well. You know, the extent to which we can apply those sorts of ideas, which are significant in the way which we imagine the British play sport, and the extent to which we can actually apply those to warfare. You know, so can the language be similar? Can we talk about it in similar sorts of ways? So I guess, yeah, in terms of, and then it goes on to, I mean, we talked about the debates over Sunday sport, you know, how kind of outsiders were treated and how, you know, issues in terms of race were dealt with in terms of the war. So those are all important here. So I think overall, what I was kind of trying to do with the chapter was really just understand the extent to which sport became elevated in not so much in terms of what took place, but in terms of the way in which it was positioned in the narrative, in the ordinary narrative of kind of you know, newspapers and others, the extent to which it became elevated as a really key aspect of the nation, and the way in which it was considered to encapsulate the British people. So you're right, there is this tension, I think, in these debates around, you know, what the nation is and what the people are. But I think what I felt very much is that even when a lot of sport wasn't taking place, sport became more central and more core to these debates of how we see ourselves and how we see ourselves at these times of tension and stress than even before. And so I think that was one of the things I wanted to explore in this final chapter.
Well, one of the things I kind of drew from it, maybe this is just me, is that, you know, wartime British sport wasn't unified. It wasn't harmonious, but it was, and it wasn't unchanging, but it was British. And yeah, there were all of these other influences, but they weren't as strong an influence, and maybe not much of an influence at all, compared to kind of the pre-war or existing fractures within this nation, right? That continued in meaningful ways, and kind of, you know, people could imagine a kind of more harmonious post-war, but actually, as we know, like that wasn't what happened per se. But that there was something kind of that there, le plus ça change, you know, things changed, but the fractures within society didn't heal over, but they also weren't Americanized or Polishized or influenced in major ways by this global catastrophe that was happening around them. They were mostly or most strongly influenced by things that had already happened in Britain and that were happening.
Do you know what? And I think you're right about that. I think that's kind of, although I probably don't articulate it as clearly as you have then, I think that kind of is what it argues to a degree in the last chapter. And, you know, thinking about it, that's also something that I'm kind of slightly, I'm not sure that I'm putting it in another context. I mean, I'm one of the things I'm very interested in, kind of one of the things I'm working on at the moment, you know, going forward is you know, looking at, I'm very interested in the kind of transnational links, you know, and kind of transnational histories and things like that, which I've written in other contexts are really important, even in the sense that quite often, you know, the British see themselves as fairly insular in terms of sport. In certain contexts, anyway. And I think ultimately the picture I do present here, despite the fact that, you know, at various times, you know, cities like London and other cities were kind of very kind of multinational and involved, you know, and people had kind of American servicemen, people, as you say, from kind of Polish forces, Free French forces, you know, lots of people, you know, intermingling. I think the picture we have is kind of sport in wartime is relatively insular, and so in that sense, despite what I've said elsewhere, I think there is an element where the wartime period is a slight interruption from what was happening elsewhere, which is interesting as well, because I think in terms of the First World War, from what I've understood about that, that isn't the case at all. I think I do, certainly in terms of the way people saw the values associated with sport and how that connected to so-called national values. I do think, you know, that is very much connected to a traditional notion of Britishness, which is felt, the need to protect that is very high on people's agenda.
I want to highlight, and before I ask a final question, one of the things that this is how I brought up the questions, but it kind of ties into the last thing you said, which is the way in which these kind of traditional ideas were actually quite flexible. So in that final chapter, of course, you have a big section on the role or the kind of reception of Black athletes in Britain. And although it's a big change that Black athletes are increasingly present, they're kind of in the context of the war seen as that their participation is seen as necessary as part of fair play and as a contrast to what the United States is doing, trying to kind of preserve color barriers. And another thing that's often comes up in your book, and you bring it up a lot, and I didn't bring it up in chatting with you, is the increasing role of women in all of these sporting movements, but that oftentimes their participation is couched in very traditional ways, like working class women make claims to sporting leisure on the basis of their improvement of their labor and things like that, rather than as a kind of challenge to, as a kind of gendered challenge to, you know. So that's a really big part of your book, and I didn't bring that up, but for readers who are going, hey, what about women? What that is in the book, I promise.
Just really quickly, I mean, on the issue of race, I mean, I think, you know, without going into huge details about it, I think it's crucial. I mean, elsewhere I've written quite a lot about boxing and the color bar, and I think, you know, it's more than just boxing, but I think in terms of that story, what was happening in the Second World War in Britain is absolutely crucial to understand that and how attitudes change. On the role of women, I think you're right. I think I made the decision early on, and I think it was the right decision to, I didn't want a chapter just on women, you know, that makes no sense, because they were so important to, at various points. I mean, I think attitudes to women workers are actually a key part of the fourth chapter, where I talk about kind of work fitness and play. And I think I am dealing with, both the tension between traditional attitudes, but also the ability to be flexible at certain times, and the fact that many women were pushing against those sorts of ideas. And I think, although, you know, I encourage people to read the book to find out more about that, I've also kind of written a little bit more about that with Raf Nicholson. So Raf, kind of colleague, who she actually wrote her MA thesis on women in the Second World War, and she was generous enough to let me have a look at that while I was writing the book. And at various times I said to her, this is really great, you need to publish this. And so when we were given the opportunity to write a piece for a special issue of sporting history, I said, well, Raf, we need to draw on your resources here, because she had some great material, which I think added significantly to what I had. So I think although there's some good stuff in there, I think that's also the place to go to an article we wrote in Sporting History, which is, I think, a much broader encapsulation of, you know, how rich this history of women's sport in the Second World War was.
All right, Matt, final question I ask people, and you've hinted to it already. What are you working on now? What can we look forward to reading from you next?
Okay, so the thing I'm kind of working on hoping to finish reasonably soon is a kind of slightly more than a textbook, but it's a kind of general synthesis, which I've called World of Sport, which is about kind of the, I suppose it's about the link between sports history and transnational history, and the way in which sports history, I think, the issue of sport can feed into what we understand about transnational history. And so that kind of it was also arranged thematically, but it takes you through kind of the mid 19th century, through to the 20th century. Through to the 1960s. What I really want to do with that book is, I think more than anything else, there is some primary source material, but I want to point out the incredible work that people are already doing, which even if they don't kind of label it as transnational history, I think is really important to those who are doing kind of transnational and global history. I think sport has a lot to give to that, and there's some great work already going on, but also I think point ahead to how more can be done in terms of that. So that's the main thing I'm doing. And then an idea that I've got after that, which may or may not develop, is a history of women's boxing in Britain.
A history of women's boxing in Britain definitely needs to be written. And world of sports sounds really important and useful. I'm thinking immediately like that there's a huge gap in the kind of teaching market. There's no really good new kind of readable accounts of sport, how it emerges in a kind of broad way, and how it's linked to kind of contemporary questions, maybe that, as you're pointing to transnational history, but these kind of contemporary historiographical questions. So it sounds like it will be a very useful book for sports historians teaching our increasingly common history courses in sports.
Well, that's good to hear. It means I'm not wasting my time, hopefully.
Great. Oh, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to a new Books in Sports, a channel on the New Books Network. I've been speaking with Matthew Taylor. He's a professor in history at De Montfort University. He's also the author of Sport and the Home Front, Wartime Britain at Play, 1939 to 45. It is out with Routledge in their Studies in Modern British History in 2020. It's great. Pick it up, read it, and wish you'd read it 2 years ago. Thank you so much, Matt, for joining us.
Thanks, Keith.